Welcome to Wired on Development. This is episode 4. I'm so excited to be able to bring you this interview with Judy Carmack. Judy is pure gold. I feel like I've discovered a hidden treasure, and I feel so lucky to have been able to capture some of Judy's thoughts and experiences on my podcast. I know that Judy's insights are going to change the way that I practice as a pediatric physio. If you're signed up for the weekly emails of Seriously Smart Snippets that take less than 5 minutes to read, you'll know that this week we identified 4 habits of brilliant clinicians. Judy excels at each one of these. I hope you love this interview as much as me, and if you haven't already, make sure you check out Judy's blog site where you can see her magic in action. A special thanks to Beverly Kuzik for recommending and putting me in contact with Judy. Judy got her degree at Columbia University, and she starts off by telling us who her greatest influence was there. Enjoy.
Get Wired on Development.
My favorite teacher there was Signe Blomström, and she was a Swedish lady who was a PhD in kinesiology and moved to the United States and taught at NYU and at Columbia and did research on kinesiology with physical therapy. And she was a fantastic teacher and a little ball of fire. And I learned so much from her, and we had to do a lot of reading, research on articles and things like that. I didn't realize how fantastic she was because it was new to me. So I remember this very clearly, though it was a long time ago. This man came in. He was in his middle 50s or close to 60. He had had a stroke 5 years before. He could walk. He looked quite good, except for his hand. His hand was very tight, and he couldn't open it. And she couldn't open it at first. And we just sat there watching what she did, and she talking to him. And at the end of the hour, he was opening his hand and reaching in all sorts of directions. And he said, "This is really interesting. You know that? I haven't opened this hand in 5 years."
So what was she doing with him?
She was doing her thing, which was not NDT. The Bobas and Signe Blomström did not get along.
Right.
And we had a Blomström, we had a Bobath clinic at the Presbyterian Hospital where Columbia is. And I would go by there to look in the door and see if I could see something. They would close the door. They wouldn't let any students in. And so I didn't know anything about Bobath until I left school, of course, and later and went back to California. But she does more her method, and she's written several books. She called it more functional type based on kinesiology. But she used basically whatever the client could do. She would start with that movement. She would ask him, "Move your arm here, or open your hand for this person, particular person. Move your hand here, open your hand." And he couldn't do it. He'd maybe close it, pull it up to his chin or something, go the other way. She would work with that. So you pull up to your chin, you go in that direction, and then you find that he could relax going the other way. And eventually she'd get him to reach out, and then reach out, close your hand, and then okay, now let's just let go. Now close your hand, let go, and eventually the hand would open. Now we know that the spastic muscles are the weaker ones.
Yes.
So in a sense, she was working on getting the spastic muscles to work.
That's very interesting.
I based a lot of my work on her. After I graduated, I went to the Rusk Institute to work there for 2 years. And then my husband graduated med school by then. And so then we moved. And so I worked for a visiting nurse for a year while he did his internship. We went to Sicily for 3 years, then we came back, and then I worked in Philadelphia, a general hospital, and it was small. Rarely did I get a child, and I stayed there for 3 years while we did that. I was the department head, as a matter of fact, and then we got to go back to California, which was wonderful, and I went to work for California Children's Services, and that's when I started physical therapy with children and learned about Bobath. And so everybody said, "Oh, you can't do that. You have to do..." I was doing the Blomström kind of things, and they were afraid I was going to make the spasticity go up because I was doing what she did.
Working into it
and seeing where we could go with it. So I took the NDT classes and Joan Moore weekend classes first. Finally got to take an 8-week course. Pam Mullins, of course, and Lois Bly. I learned a lot from them. And there's things with NDT that we still need to be using and thinking about, I believe.
What sort of things?
And well, for Pam Mullins, she was wonderful about sensation for the child and how to keep the child happy. Gross motor too, but I mean, she was so good about how the child feels when he can't move, to think about that when you're working with a child. And like, I learned a lot from her. With Lois, of course, I took the baby class too, and that was terrific. And I think with all the NDT classes, you learn how to look at movement and how to see what's missing, and how to do some handling and feel what you can see. It's important. We don't need to keep holding the handling and preventing the child from moving. That's ridiculous, but that's kind of a myth about it. And I think NDT has changed with the times, as we all have. But I notice that when I teach my electrical STEM classes, the people that have had the NDT things know how to combine the electrical stim with the functional part of therapy better. It's just easier for them to catch on about doing that. And I think that that helps. Without having the experience of handling them and feeling what it's like and what they're trying to do, I think you miss. So I think we need those things together.
Yeah. So do you think in your practice you've combined the Brunstrom and the NDT concepts along with the kinesiology together?
Yes, I do. That mix it all in. Because with kinesiology, you need to know how the muscles work, when they work for the particular task. And so you want to know what you want to do. And originally when I was doing mostly NDT and some Brunstrom things in, but I did follow what people were saying, though I was a little concerned about it, but I was learning it, so I used it, right?
Right.
And then had one child who was opostotonic at age 10. It took about 10 minutes to be able to fold him up to get him into a lap. That was when I started with him. And the family wanted to do selective dorsal rhizotomies.
Mm-hmm.
So they went to Dr. Peacock. He did the surgery. But before he did the surgery, he wanted me to do biofeedback with EMGs. And I'd never done it before anyway. So I wanted to use the equipment on him and see how it works. So Medtronic gave me EMG equipment. And I tried it on the child. I'd ask him to kind of try to move this muscle. I wanted him to feel that he could move this muscle. Well, he was opostotonic, as I said, and he tried to move anything with the machine on. He just even tried harder, and he just moved everything. I mean, there was nothing you could do with that. I mean, it was just too much. I didn't like it, and I told the salesperson that after I tried it for a week or something. She said, "Have I ever tried electrical stim?" And I said, "Child, no, I've never done that." And so she said, "Well, it does work. You can try it." So she gave me a Respond Select at that time, and I put it on him, and it was wonderful. Because he relaxed. But I was doing the traditional thing. I was doing the alternate to the spastic muscle because we were told that the spastic muscles were strong and overactive and preventing their antagonists from working. But I began to use it on other children too and to see what was happening. I had one 4-year-old child who couldn't talk, but she could walk on her toes. And I wanted to try and see what would happen. So I put it on her anterior tib, just as I was told, we're going to do the anterior tib. And it took about 20 minutes or more before she came down flat-footed. And then I thought, well, that's better, you know, it's okay. So I gave it to the parent. That was really the only problem she had, so I didn't see her very often. The mother called back some months later, and she said her child was much worse. She was so high on her toes, she was just as terrible, and she had stopped using it. And I said, fine, come back, bring it back and let me see. So she came back with it. And I thought, well, I'm going to put it on the calf muscles because I want her to feel the opposite. And I put one on the anterior tib and one on the calf. And then I could go back and forth. I said, this is up and this is down. And I tried, that was my plan.
Right.
intuitively, I knew that the medial calf muscle was weaker than the lateral calf muscle just by, you know, evaluation during therapy, that you could feel that on many kids. So I just decided that I'm going to do the medial calf and not the lateral calf. So the lateral calf is, it doesn't have any stimulation to it. It just completes the circuit, but it's the active is the cathode is on the medial gastroc because that also builds the arch. So I put that on her. And I put it on her, and then I turned it on, and I said, Tina, this is up. And she went down. She immediately went down flat-footed. And that was my first time I'd ever seen it. I thought, my gosh, look at, she's down. And so then I used the remote switch on and off as she was walking. And if I put it on the anterior tip, she went up on the anterior tip. And when I would switch it to the calf muscle, she wouldn't come down. If I stayed off the anterior tip, so I turned it off and just did the calf, she stayed down. And so I tried that on other children, and the same thing happens. They have immediate response. Of course, I published my paper on, the first paper on that, and I had another person from Texas, and they did a study on that, and they found that with their, they had 14 kids, and they, one group did the anterior tib, and the other group did the calf. And then they did a cross study and they switched groups. And their final result was that the anterior tib didn't need to be done. And they all had immediate responses of going down from toe walking with the calf muscle.
So how did you explain that to yourself in those early days? What did
I wondered what was happening. I thought it was a sensory awareness that maybe the child couldn't feel that muscle. They didn't know how to turn it on. They didn't know how to use it. Because the anterior tib develops first over the calf. The anterior tib is often used to bring the foot forward in young, very young children. And so I thought, well, maybe they're just using that and they don't know how to turn on for some reason. I asked several guru therapists and they said they never heard of such a thing. And their looks told me they didn't believe me either. So I thought, well, next time I'm going to ask them, I'll bring the pictures because, they, you know, if you don't see the picture or video, I didn't have the video at that time, but I did get it soon. It was just common. It happened. And afterwards, the passive range of motion was much easier for dorsiflexion. The calf muscle wasn't so hard and tight. It was soft. So I'd have the parents feel the calf before we put it on, before and after, and do the range of motion, and then we put it on and we'd see what happened. This child stayed down for a couple of days afterwards. Some children will stay and it works better till they get to the car. Some children will stay the rest of the day. Some children even have lasted 3 days. It varies. And the children that seem to be are better walkers, of course, they last longer.
Yeah. Than that. So how would you explain it now that you've been doing it for so many years and you have a lot more knowledge around it?
Well, the calf muscle is weaker than the anterior tib. The anterior tib is much stronger than the calf muscle, even though it's not as strong as it should be. And the literature shows that. I've got those listed in my articles, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it gives them a sensory motor function. And you want to turn it on during the task. You're not interested in doing it while they're lying in bed asleep because they have no awareness of it. And besides, that's they're doing when they do that, they're doing the anterior tib, which is not the muscle you need. The anterior tib works at heel strike to loading. That's when it works besides the swing. But it only needs to get to 90 degrees in the swing. It doesn't have to go into dorsiflexion.
Right.
But the calf muscle is normally 17 times stronger than the anterior tib in the adult. And the calf muscle has to grow from 2 years old to 4 years old, it doubles in size. It's catching up where the anterior tib is already can lift the foot. The calf muscle has to lift the whole body with each step. So just think of how many times you're lifting that body up. And so then you grow to be an adult. The calf muscle from ages 4 to adolescence almost doubles again in size. It's very important. It's the major postural muscle of the body.
So why do you think you get such a quick response with electrical stim? Because it takes a long time to strengthen a muscle, but you're seeing immediate effects.
It's not strengthening it. It's causing more muscle fibers to work.
Right.
It's causing it to work in a coordinated way, because if you've got the stim coming on and then you let go of the switch, it's off. So you turn it off during swing and you turn it on during stance. And that's what gives that sensory motor stuff, and it's actually making more fibers contract than had been contracting before. And I think that with the sensory input, the brain gets messages back that this calf is now working. And we know that electrical stim has been shown to influence the spinal cord as well as the brain, as it brings the afferent impulses back up into the brain and spinal cord. It can then say, oh, it's here, we can use it. I think that's what's happening. Something gets woken up in the brain that they didn't feel it before. There was no input, no afferent input from the muscle because it wasn't being used.
Right. So the immediate effect is around a sensory awareness, and then...
It's a sensory motor. It's sensory motor.
Yeah.
Some children, you have to go up a little higher than other children. You go up, if you turn on the amplitude, you watch the child's face. I put a vibrator on the calf first and say, do you like that? Does that feel good? And that, the first time that we do something like this, especially if the child is cognizant and can talk to you, I mean, it's nice to do that. He said, now I'm going to, I don't want to hold this while you walk around. I can't bend down there and hold that. So I want to put this on while you're walking around, and then we can play ball or whatever you want to do with. So when I wanted to publish this, I decided that nobody would believe me, so I needed to do the children that I had done the anterior tip and the calf. And I had two boys that were ages 6 and 9 that had dropped foot, and they had atrophy. You could look at the front of the leg and see that the anterior tib was atrophied. There's kind of a hollow there rather than the muscle coming out. So I put it on the anterior tib and the calf, and I alternated with when they walked. I didn't want them just to have it on the anterior tib because I knew that both were going to be weaker than most children. And maybe that's because they had hemiplegia. With diplegia, they have to switch sides, and it may give more work to the other side. But with the child with hemiplegia, they can stay on their uninvolved leg and not work the other leg very much at all. And it worked very well with them. The 9-year-old, actually, he wanted to do his own switch, and he could do it accurately with his own time. And it just lasted about 3 months, and he didn't need it anymore.
Wow.
The other boy, I've forgotten how long it lasted. I saw him for his hand. We stopped doing the calf because he didn't seem to need it either, but I can't remember how many months it took.
Okay. So you're talking about publishing, and I'm just thinking, when you're working as a clinician, how difficult it is to kind of manage that balance between actually putting research or papers out there and just managing caseloads and that sort of thing. So how did you manage all of that, Judy?
Well, by that time, my kids were in high school and they weren't little kids, so I had more time than mothers that have young kids, and I think that helps. I wanted this to get out, that people should think that we shouldn't be doing weakening of these spastic muscles. Those muscles are needed. I published my first paper in 1994, and I did it of these two boys and said that we need to do the calf, but I put the two of them. I was afraid if I had just done those children that I don't do the anterior tib, that wouldn't be accepted. But they published it, and I also published the hand one at the same time. And it was a new idea, and they took it. And I actually got an award for that as the best paper of the year. And then I published the other one in Developmental Medicine and Child Neurology a couple of years later. And then I said, let's just do task-specific electrical stim and do it to the spastic muscles. And I did it to more muscles because more muscles are needed. So I did the gastroc and the gluteus maximus, and I didn't talk about having done it to the adductors and the hamstrings because I thought that would be another thing that people would be upset about. Actually, I was afraid to do that for a while because of my training too, that you're going to dislocate the hips. But the adductors are very, very large muscles, and they act throughout most of gait, except in mid-swing. They must be there for a reason. So I tried it on one child who was 4 years old. He was the first child I tried to do the electrical stim without doing bracing, because the family didn't want bracing. I think you really need to do both. You have to have bracing and the electrical stim to have the carryover come through and has more hours of the day with the foot getting heel strike.
Mm-hmm.
Not with a solid ankle brace, but with a hinge brace, because you have to have dorsiflexion in there, and you want the muscle and the joint to be working at the correct timing. And if you have a solid ankle brace, you have to substitute your body to get your body over this locked ankle. So you don't want that. And so this is the first child that I had. He had no orthopedic surgeon that was saying he wanted to do surgery. And he was 2 years old when I started with him. It was by spastic diplegia. So I put the stim on him, on his adductors one day, just to see what would happen, because he didn't use the braces and I was losing the foot. He was going up on his toes. At 4 year old growth spurt was just too much and I couldn't handle it. So he was on his toes and I thought, well, I'm going to try the adductors, because he had no worry. He could side sit on either side. He had no problems with hip dislocation. So I put it on the adductors and he came down immediately. And he's staying playing card game at a bench. He abducted his feet and stood there. It was football season, and you know how football players do side-to-side things with their feet apart, and they're doing, and I thought, well, maybe he's watching television and his dad are watching football, and he's doing this kind of, reminded me of a football player who is doing this kind of stretching side-to-side. And he did that as he was playing with the cards on the table. I thought that was really interesting. So I wanted to see if that would work on a child who had no stim at all. The first time he ever came to me, he had no stim, and I wanted to try it to the adductors. Would he come down? Did this boy come down because he had already had the stim on the calf muscles? And so I tried it on another two-year-old on his. The first visit, we just do evaluation and getting familiar with him and playing and talking and seeing how he does. And the next visit, if we have a good rapport by then I can put the stim on. So I put the stim on him while he was standing at a table. He did not walk alone. He walked if his both hands were held, or he walked if his left arm was held. He would not walk if his right arm was held. If you hold with just one right arm, he wouldn't walk. He'd sit down and cry. He had spastic diplegia, and he would not let me side sit him on the right side. I couldn't weight shift him to the right side either. So that's why he did have that reaction, I think, because he didn't have the typical range of motion. He was tighter on the right hip. So I decided I was going to try this just to see what would happen. So he was standing at the table. He could stand at a table and hold onto the table without falling off and play like that. So I put it on the right hip abductor as he played at the table.
Abductor, abductor.
Adductor. Adductor. The medial one. And it went on and off 15 seconds. And first he began to just kind of weight shift more to the right side, put more weight on it. He was standing on both legs, but more weight was obviously on the left. And he began to shift to the right. And that happened. And he was still playing with his toe. Then all of a sudden he stopped and he looked down at his leg. He picked his whole leg up and abducted it to the side as he picked the hip and knee up off and put his hand on the thigh on top of where the electrode was, but he didn't try to pull it off. And then he put the foot down and he just played with that. And then after, 10 minutes or more standing at the table playing, then I put the remote switch in and I walked with him and he let me hold his right hand. And we walked around to the right hand and he shifted to the right hand. Then he went to the window ledge and tried to get him to sidestep to the right and left, because you have to abduct as you sidestep. And I could use the remote switch to turn it on at the time that it would be needed. And it worked very well. And then he let his mother walk with him with the right hand. So we did that with him. And he never had any hip problems. There was no problem that he would dislocate that right hip or anything like that. So then I began to use that on other children. And of course, then I began to do it on a lot of kids. And it makes sitting posture so much better.
So it sounds to me like a lot of your technique has just been developed through your own curiosity and trial and error.
Oh, yes, yes. But, yeah. Of course, you read a lot. You know, you read the literature and the articles on things. Much of it, though, is opposite of what I found. But you want to know your kinesiology and you want to know your development.
When I see your photos of you using the electrical stimulation and the progress that you make with the children, it looks just amazing. And I'm just wondering why it hasn't taken off more sort of worldwide. You know, it's not a technique that is commonly used in pediatrics.
I think there's a few reasons. When I published my first paper, MPE invited me to teach for them. And so they set up workshops, and I would go teach at different hospitals or wherever they made it. And I was a single mother by then, and I was afraid to be too much away from my practice because that was my only income, our main income. And so I just said I would do six or eight places a year. So that's what we set up for. And when I went to the places, some people were very, very skeptical. And even though they saw the videos and they saw what was happening, or I did it on a demo on a kid and the kid acted just as I said they would do, they were still reluctant to try it. Then when you get to the practicum part of it and they put it on, some people would still put it on instead of the wrist finger flexors, they put it on the wrist extensors. And then you put on the wrist extensors, you get more wrist extension, but you don't get the finger part. So there are things you can do opposite of the traditional way of doing it, and you get some improvement. But you don't get the same amount of improvement as you do as when you use the muscles that are the weakest. And we know the finger flexors are very weak, and the wrist flexors are weak. And now there's more articles out just this recently showing that the finger flexors are weak. And when the hand is really fisted, Lieber has done some and published papers, and of course that's where I get most of my information, but they may have long tendons and short muscles when we do the surgery. You can lengthen the tendon, so you need to make the muscle grow, you need to make the muscle function, to make the muscle contract and relax, contract. That's why the stim is so great, because it will do that. Yeah. So then also, I'm not an OT, but I've got lots of years of working with OTs and reading about how to do it with the hand. And I do it a PT's way of working with a hand. But some of the therapists in the class would say, you're not an OT, so you should have an OT teach this part of it. But I didn't know any OT that knew the electrical stim or was able to. So I just let that go. But I think that's why. But now more therapists are following what I'm saying and doing it, especially in Brazil. They just listen and do what you say. And you can see on my webpage, judykarmic.com, I put up some pictures that we got when I was teaching there last year that the students got in that hour's worth of therapy and how the child looked at the beginning of the hour and at the end of the hour.
So, Judy, who else are you sort of working with or collaborating with around electrical stim?
Well, I taught one therapist in California, Susan Hastings, and she came several times. She was enthusiastic about learning and learned quite very quickly, and she's an excellent therapist. She's really the only one in this country that I've seen. In Brazil, they do a lot.
Right.
But then when MPE went underground and they stopped having people teach. I'm not a marketer, so I didn't get as many classes to teach. And I've learned a lot over the years, a lot more with the hip. And I've got several papers that I want to publish, and sometimes it's a little difficult, like you say. I have some nice videos and pictures that I'd like to show, but I want them in the publication. And if I put them on my webpage, I can't publish them.
Oh, really? Okay. So they have to get into the publications first.
That's my feeling, right, because I still want to do that.
I just wanted to know how your time was going and if we could just keep going.
My time is fine.
Should I just read the questions out and then you can answer them?
Yeah, that'd be probably better.
Okay, so the first question says, hi, Judy, do you see children with autism and other sensory processing difficulties? Do they respond differently to the electrical stimulation than children without those issues?
I don't see children with autism, so I have no experience with that. I saw a lot of children with Down syndrome, and the stim worked very quickly with them on their calf muscles and their adductors. I wanted them to learn to sit and go over their leg with adduction instead of this wide abduction that they had. And they wanted the foot to be with some arch. So I did the medial gastroc, and they learned to walk very, very quickly, very well. And we used Schmoes, and of course, Billy Kuzak, I took her classes on how to mold orthotics. And so I made Schmoes for my children with Down syndrome and use the electrical stim. I wanted them to have an ankle, but I wanted the heel to be more vertical and to have a subtalar neutral position as well as possible. And they often didn't use the bracing for very few months because then the stim helped the muscle develop. It worked well. Okay. I did publish one letter with a photograph of using the SMO. It was with another study on Downs and just added my letter with that in there.
Is that on your website?
Yes, it's on my website. There's a list of my journals on the website. Think of the stem as a way to get the muscle to exercise with feeling. Currently, I'm working with a child with Rett syndrome. I haven't worked with her very long yet. Her scoliosis is getting better just in this few weeks that we're doing this. And the right hip wouldn't go down to the floor when she's cross-legged sitting. It was up off the floor. It's come down to the floor. And she will smile when you put the stim on. She'd like, and I've given her a choice. Do you want to walk or do you want to sit today? And she doesn't talk, but she would look at a hand in one hand, just look at this hand and it's walking, this hand and sit. And she just looked for the walking. So we did the walking. And she just grinning when we were walking. And she wasn't doing that before. And I think it's the sensory thing was giving her some feeling. And I did the sensory on an adult CP, occupational therapist, and she heard my first lecture and she said to me, I want to work with you. So this was wonderful because I learned from her. And I put it on her hand and she said, oh my gosh, my hand never felt so like this before ever. And she said, give me a steragnosis test. I got several things out. I said, but I've never did it before. And she said, that's okay. I couldn't pass it all through OT school. So we did the steragnosis test, and I got things in together rather quickly that was in the room. And she knew the key and the ball and the coin, a couple of toys. Only one thing she didn't know, and that was a very hard thing. Those old erasers, you know, there's an eraser on the top of a pencil, but you can also buy a little square eraser or something.
Yeah.
You hold it. She didn't know what that was. But she knew everything else. Even when I showed it to her, she said, what's that?
And so was that after you'd done the electrical stim or while you had the electrical stim on?
No, the steragnosis test was after. Take the stim off. And first, you should do it before you put it on. You can do it after. And they'll usually get one or two. And I had one child who was 6 years old who got all of it afterwards. Had none of it beforehand, not even the ball. And afterwards knew it all.
Amazing.
And it was really amazing. But
so Judy, I'll just ask the next question then. Do you have different protocols for weak muscles versus spastic muscles? And how do you decide which muscles to start with?
Spastic muscles are the weak muscles. So there's no difference in the protocol. You put it on the muscle that's needed. And usually the spastic muscles are the one that's needed. And it depends on your task. So if you're using reach, grasp, and release, you could use the finger flexors. You can use the median ulnar nerve of the hand. This is wonderful. The intrinsics of the hand and the thumb. So it depends on what the child is doing. If the child can't reach forward at all, you want, of course, the hand to be open, but you could take anything you can get at the beginning. You might need to do latissimus dorsi because that muscle, you'd think it was... It's a crutch walking arm, it will bring it back, but it doesn't. When you put that on, the arm goes forward so easily. It's just fantastic. So it depends on, you have to know what you want. What is it that you want? What muscle does that? Or what muscle is stopping them from doing that? And then think about the spasticity. And if she's very spastic around there, I would do the spastic muscles first. You do it only to tolerance. I wrote a paper that was published in 2014, a letter to somebody's paper, Ada and the other's paper. They're very good therapists and very good researchers, but they didn't seem to think electrical stim helped. But there's two basic ways of doing electrical stim. One is the traditional way, in which you do the antagonist to the spastic muscle, and you want mm-hmm. the amplitude to be as high as possible. Mm-hmm. And that's not the way I do it. You want it to be the spastic muscle itself, the muscle that is the weakest that is needed, and you don't want the maximum voluntary contraction. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Damanano says, oh, it has to be 65% maximum volume contraction or you're not getting increased strength. But there's a paper recently that showed that they did it with a young adult and they had damage to the muscle. But when they went down to 15% maximum voluntary contraction, they had progress. I put it as high as the child tolerates it. And less, even, depending on, you see the reaction, like the little boy that was the two-year-old was abducting his leg when I put it on the adductors. I put it until I saw he was weight shifting to that other side. He's not going to tell me that's enough. But he was functioning well. So I stopped there. After a few minutes, he could accommodate to that, and maybe you could go up a couple of amps, milliamps, because he might have no sensation again because he's accommodated, his body's accommodated. You want to keep them aware of the stimulation, and you would like to have muscle contraction that is palpable or that you can even see, but it doesn't have to be at 65% maximum voluntary contraction. I think that's a mistake.
Right. So once you've got the muscle and they're using it in your therapy sessions, then what's the next step? Do you send the parents home with it? And how often are you recommending that they use it?
I tried sending it home, but it's best to wait for the parent to say, gee, that's so good. Why can't I do that?
Right.
And then, because if you encourage them to go home and they're not ready for it yet, then it doesn't work as well. They feel guilty about it and they can't do it. But if they really want to, I always tell them in the class, in the therapy session, what I'm doing. And sometimes, like in the picture that you have of me, I've got two units and two remote switches. And I can use three myself. But if I want a fourth one, I'll often give it to the parent. And say, when the knee is in this position, you turn it on and then you turn it off. On, off. And so they're getting into it. Get them to learn how to do things, mostly just the general idea of it, not with the switch so much. Then when they go home, you take the one muscle group, bilateral, if they're bilateral, or if they're hemiplegic, you can take two muscles on the same leg. So they put it on, and they've done it many, many times in your office, putting it on and seeing it, and they can do it because it's so easy for them to get the wires mixed up or to do mistakes. It's not an easy thing for a therapist, let alone a parent. I've had some parents, though, that have gone home with two remote switches, and they've done quite well. But there's not many of them. But you get the doctor's permission, and then you can send it home. And so you pick something that the parent can do easily with things like that. But the therapist has to know that they like what they see before they send it home.
Right. And then how often do you recommend they use it?
If a child is level 5, I think they need to do 4 days a week. Those children have done very well, and they have not dislocated hips that have been expected. Oh, we're going to do surgery right away. They didn't have to do the surgery.
4 days a week, and how long?
20 minutes. 20 minutes at a time.
Okay. During a functional task.
Well, if you're working on posture, they could even be just sitting and having playing at a table, or they could be in their standing table, and then you don't need the remote switch. It all depends on the child. Now, if a child is a level 1, they could do fine with once or twice a week at home. The more often it is, the faster the progress. But the levels 4 and 5 really need many days a week. But they still benefit, but not quite as quickly if they don't.
So I'm just thinking then of the level 5s. If I had a child with a level 5 that, say, had particularly tight hamstrings that we were worried about, and I wanted to use electrical stim in a functional task, what would be your recommendation?
Well, at level five, I've done the hamstrings, but I'm holding them in gait, or they're standing in their standing table, or they can even be supine and with the legs out. And you'll see after 15 minutes, you'll get at least 20 to 40 degrees increased in knee extension. It works quite well. And same thing for abduction. You can do the abduction in sitting. And you can do it in a long leg sitting, ring sitting, or cross-legged sitting.
And what sort of a response would you be looking for to see how high to turn it up?
Easy abduction.
Okay.
You measure the abduction, take a photograph, see where the legs are. It's kind of good to read my literature so that you're not doing the wrong parameters.
Yeah.
Traditionally, people have very high parameters, and they want the pulse duration to be very low and a high amplitude. It's the opposite.
Right. And you've got that all in your articles that are on your blog.
Yes, in some of my articles. That's what we teach in the class. It's not really easy to do, and it gets easier the more you do it and when you understand it. You have to take time to learn it. Try it on yourself. See what it feels like. I learned to do it by myself. Lucinda Baker's book was very good, and I used that. It was for adults, but that was a good beginning book. And she's coming out, I think, with a fourth edition. So, and that's good because it has photographs of where electro placement and so forth. But then remember that she would do the anterior tib.
Yes.
She didn't just do that, but was very, very useful for me.
Okay. I'll go on to the last question, which says, I have a child with SMA type 3, non-ambulatory. He's 10 years old and has scoliosis. Any recommendations to delay or stop the progression of his curve? He also suffers from extreme fatigue. Any recommendations are highly appreciated.
Well, that's where you think that electrical stim is exercise. And as I understand it, we're now doing exercise for this type of child, as long as he has no indwelling heart catheter or anything that's indwelling. You have to check those things out. So then they can generally be allowed to use the electrical stim.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you might change your parameters on this child. If they're just sitting and doing it for posture, it goes on the initially 15 seconds and off 15 seconds. And as they get stronger and better and more endurance, then I drop it to 12 because that's more fatiguing. More than 15 is too long. And also they don't feel it's ever going to go off, and they get a little worried about it. So that's the maximum I use. And then you can drop it down as their endurance increases. So I use a 1-to-1 ratio. Then you could say maybe do 12 seconds on, 24 or more seconds off. That means that both channels, both are going to go on at the same time because you can't alternate them. One would be on very long. You can't do that. So you could do a short on 12 seconds and then a long off and see. Maybe just the first time, just try 10 minutes or even 5 minutes to see how the child tolerates it and how the fatigue is. And then the next time, see if you can get to do 15 or 20 minutes with a long time. Mm-hmm. And it turns out they're not tired at all. Then you could decrease the off time to make it easier. I would use the abdominals. I would use... Feel a trunk. This is where the NDT was so nice. When you feel a trunk and you see, is his scoliosis because he's pulling down on this side or because he's weak on this side? So you want to feel where it is. And on my webpage, there's some pictures of, I think it's just one child, maybe there's two, of where you can put the muscles, the stim on the muscles, and one child, and they're both leaning to the left, but the stim go in on different places for these two different children. You put it on and see what works for that child. If it doesn't work very well, turn it off. Move it. Try a different place. See what works for that child. You don't have to wait 6 months to see if it's going to work. You're going to see it right away. So that's what I teach in my classes, and it might be a good way to learn about some things that way.
Absolutely. So just about your classes and how you get out there, Judy, how do people get hold of you to do courses for them, and where are you traveling to do them?
Well, I'm going to Georgia on the 20th of April, and then I'm going to Brazil in June, and I'll teach three classes in Brazil, two beginners and one advanced. They need to be willing to invite me to come. Email me and I will tell you what we could do.
Okay, so people can just contact you directly if they're interested.
Yes, yes, I'd be happy to come.
Okay. Can you recommend some books, or what are your favorite books that you would use as a go-to resource or recommend for other therapists to use?
Carr and Shepherd. They did movement science, and they published in 88 was their first book, and Lois Bly told me about that, actually. Another one that they did that I like very much is called Neurological Rehabilitation. Carr works with adults, and Shepherd works with both. And they used to come to Chicago and teach every couple of years and so forth. So I went, heard them about three times, and I thought they were wonderful. In the book on movement science, there's other authors like James Gordon and A.M. Gentile and Gene Held. And so I read their things, even though it's mostly adults. But Shepherd has also a book on pediatrics, which is no longer available. But their neurological rehab is really good. And then, of course, I liked Shumway Cook, Motor Control. And there's another book called Hand Function in the Child, the Foundation for Remediation, Henderson and Pushki, P-E-H-O-S-K-I. I like those. And, of course, I like Lois Bly's books.
What would you recommend for therapists that are newly coming into pediatric neurodevelopment?
I don't know what they're teaching in the schools, but I think they're still teaching the same thing, that spastic muscle is the one we have to get rid of. I don't know if that's true. We need to really look at what are we doing? What are we getting, what we think we're getting? So you can get improvement in gait by strengthening the quad, but is that the improvement we want? Or with the one boy that I saw whose father was an orthopedic surgeon, and he had had lots of orthopedic surgery, and my children don't get that. And so he wanted, I guess his dad heard about it and he wanted to see what would happen. So he came and I put it on his legs, and he walked with lobster on crutches. I put it on and he said, "Oh my gosh, this is so easy. Everybody always told me to straighten my knee, and you're telling me to bend my knee. It's so much easier to bend my knee when I'm walking." Of course it is. But everybody focuses on the anterior tip and the quad. And the quad gives 10% of your gait, of power to the gait. The gluteus maximus gives 30, and the calf gives 40 to 50%. So you don't need to spend so much time on the quad.
Mm.
It's all your NDT classes, right? You got up and you walk with your knees bent. It's hard. Your calf, your quad is working, overworking. You can strengthen it, stim it with electrical stim. Say, "Oh, look, he's walking better because I stimmed the quad." Yes, he's gaining weight, he's growing, and now the quad can overwork even more. He really needs other muscles to bring the legs straighter. People are doing the walk aid and they're stimming the anterior tib. But what is happening? With the hinged braces, the children can progress to not need them. We go down to a SMO and then to just a SMO in their shoe. I have never read anything about that happening with the walk aid. They keep it for a lifetime.
Right.
Because when you stimulate the anterior tib, according to Chuck Leonard, and he's published this, that it inhibits the calf muscle very much. That calf muscle has to double in size, remember? And if we keep inhibiting it, why is it going to double? The other thing with the walk aid, when I've looked on YouTube and seen kids walking in it, they seem to lift their foot up too soon. You don't get plantar flexion, and you don't get push off or round off, or however you're going to call it. And I kind of see that in the walk aid, that they're not getting the body forward over the leg very much because there's no plantar flexion. Their lift off is coming sooner. They're more worried about lifting the foot up. And you only need 90 degrees at the ankle to get swing through. You don't need to have dorsiflexion. You get the dorsiflexion on the heel strike, and then you get the plantar flexion as it comes down into the loading. So I think that's a mistake just to do the anterior tib. I think they should not do the anterior tib and do the other. And if you still need it, then you can add it later, and you'll see, like they did in Texas, that they didn't need to do the anterior tip.
So what are you using to do your eStim?
What am I using? What equipment, you mean?
Yes.
I'm using the Continuum. You want the stim to have a remote switch so you can control the timing. you want to be able to change the parameters. Some of the very cheap ones you can't. You can only change the amplitude. You can't change the pulse duration or the ramp or anything you want. No ramp during gait. You can have a ramp other times, but I've even done it with very spastic children to have it come on fast, and it's been okay. It hasn't bothered them at all. You could start with a low ramp, but you don't need a 4-second ramp. That's too long. And the children will say, oh, it's never going to stop. It's going up and up and up, and it's never going to stop. 4 seconds didn't sound like long, but it really is. You want to be able to control that. When one wire pulls out, now it's very easy to have it pull out. The child's walking around the room. You're walking with them and trying to keep up with them. And you might catch a wire on a piece of furniture, and it might pull off one electrode. That means the other electrode should go off automatically. You want this machine that will turn off if a circuit's broken, because then they'll get a shock otherwise. I had 2 kids. One was 4 and one was 16, and I was trying it on them, and they both cried, and they had never cried. Yeah. And they liked the stim. So I said, that's enough of that one. I won't do that. So this is the only one that I know of. If you find another one, please let me know, that has a remote switch, parameters that will shut off if one wire pulls out or electrode pulls off, the other one's still there.
So that's the continuum.
And affordable, yes. Now, there's one that's come out for a couple $1,000 or so now. It's not very portable either. You have this great big thing that goes on a small table with wheels on it. The child isn't really active. We need therapists to say that we need to do this for gait. You certainly need the remote switch. You don't want it to be on the calf muscle during swing. And you want motor learning, so you want the body to feel it at its normally timed moment.
So just tell me the name of the brand again, please, Judy.
It's the Continuum, Continuum. They don't make it anymore, though in Canada, I've heard that they are now making it.
So what do you think now that you used to believe that you no longer think is true, now that you've had so many years of experience?
Well, it's been about 30. So I did my own personal study with because my husband said, well, you keep saying the doctors are saying this. Why don't you do that? So I said, okay. And he's a PhD in engineering, so he did the math, okay. So I took all the kids that I saw for at least a month, and I had 40 kids over a 20-year period that I did the electrical stim to. What was their gross motor function level when they came? And what was their gross motor function level when they left? Now, the literature says we can't use that as an outcome. But as Wren and others have said, the more muscle strength you have, the better you are on the GMFM. And the GMFCS correlates to the GMFM. 73% of the children who had traditional therapy from Palisano and the Canadian studies, they came out that 73% of all children, no matter what they had, don't change the GMFCS. Even if you're diagnosed at 2 years old, by the time you're 17 or 19, or you don't change. You're still in that same level. So I thought, what are we doing? How are we helping these children? Now there's 26% that do change. Of those 26%, 13% get better, where they progress by lowering their number.
Yeah.
The other half of them got worse. Out of all our kids, we have 13% that get better on the GMFCS. Mm-hmm. So I looked at my kids. I have 45% that rest.
That went to a lower level.
A lower level. None got worse. But right. There's a few surgeries for the hip that were level 5s. I was afraid to do the adductors. I would love to do that study over again with children that I was not afraid to stay away from that, because the children that I've done it with the adductors, they are getting no surgeries. And Susan Henderson also is following that, and she's getting the same thing. The doctor says, why did this x-ray show better? But they won't understand that just because we're strengthening the muscles that are weak.
Right. And so when you cut and Botox those muscles, you're just contributing to the problem.
Yes. I just don't see any reason why we have to weaken those muscles. Why do you have to weaken them before you strengthen them?
Right. It's completely the wrong way around.
Yes. And so you can put the stim on, the tone drops, you can feel spasticity drops, and I think the pain would go down. The pain would be interesting. And then you might also look at the GMFCS. They're saying it's stable and it doesn't change. why should it be stable? I think that if you do the right thing, it isn't stable. And I had one boy that was a five, level five. He's 4 years old. And in a year, he became a level four. The level five's got like about 80, 90% dislocate the hips. The level four is about 7%. It's a big change. It's very important to get those fives down to four.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
The Ashworth on the studies from the doctors and so forth, they always say, oh, the Ashworth test is so much better. This is wonderful, wonderful. How can we use that as an outcome? I'd much rather use the GMFCS.
Right.
As an outcome so that they are getting functionally better. So I think we can do that. Anyway.
Right. Judy, that has been so interesting. Would you like to just let everybody know where they can find out more about your articles, how to get hold of you, all that kind of stuff?
Well, my webpage is judycarmick.com, and there's three pages on that. The first page is kind of introduction, lower extremity. The second page is upper extremity, and the third page is my publications and workshops.
Okay. And I think I've seen you on ResearchGate as well.
Oh, yes, yes.
When I look at your photos and your videos, it looks a bit like magic to me, I have to say.
Well, it's because it's the muscle. The muscle is there. The muscle's there for a reason. We don't need to weaken it. We needs to be stronger. Now, with more and more research has shown that all these muscles we thought were overpowering. They still say, oh, it's weak, but it's overpowering. It's not. How can it overpower when it's weaker than the anterior tip, the calf? It's weaker than the anterior. How can it be overpowering the calf? It's not.
Absolutely. Would you have any best advice for therapists who want to develop excellence in the field of neuromotor development and childhood disability?
Well, I think reading the books on and articles, journals. I like the Lois Bly's understanding of movement. If you haven't had any NDT, in the Ina Nova article, even though it's supposedly a red light, but it's not a red light because they weren't talking about NDT as NDT is. They're talking about old NDT. So don't let that stop you from learning about things like that.
I love that advice.
Do some handling, but you just don't keep with the handling. You do the handling to feel where it's missing, and then that's when you put stim on, where you have muscles that you want to activate, but you can't activate, and the child can't activate it.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Judy. It's been awesome listening to you talk. You have so much knowledge to share.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. You can find links to all the things we've discussed in this interview on the Wired on Development website, Thought Leaders and Influencers page. You can also sign up to get notified about our upcoming guests, and we'll send you a free PDF summary of all the tips and action points from this interview. And whilst you're there, check out the Academics Hangout page too. It's a collaborative resource for all literature-loving clinicians and academics to share and grow. I really hope to see you there. Thanks.